Hey, fellow GNTers, those of us who like our spirituality with a twist. In this episode, we continue with part three of our discussion with the inimitable Mary Kay Ryan, shamanic practitioner and teacher and Chinese medical practitioner and teacher. As pointed out in episode two, Mary Kay's complete curriculum vitae is pretty extensive and her more complete bio is in the intro to episode one. But she has decades of experience in practicing, teaching, and writing about Chinese medicine, including Treating AIDS with Chinese Medicine, one of the first textbooks addressing that subject. She also has decades of experience in shamanic practice, including teaching. Her true passion is healing the village and healing the spiritual field, the deeper truth that healing, by definition, must be a collective experience involving not only the individual, but other people, other living beings in the entire natural world. In this episode, we discuss transcendence, moving beyond the mundane, shamanism explained. Considered our various aspects of shamanic practices and approaches and getting a contact high? Yep. Enjoy.
Welcome to Jin and Tantra, spirituality with a twist. The podcast that takes Tantrism, Buddhism, Taoism, Sufism, Kabbalism, Shamanism, Chinese medicinism, and all of the other isms we've been influenced by, and blends them into a tall, crisp, cool cocktail your spirit has been longing for. Now, isn't that refreshing? I want you to get together.
That's right. Well, Mary Kay, so you've been talking quite a bit about and throwing the word shamanism around, and certainly that's how...
Sorry.
No, you're good. That's how you and I are connected. So given that we're doing the University of Chicago way of speaking and where we define... everything that we do, that we're talking about before we talk about it, let's take the next, 20 minutes or so and let's dive in a little bit into something that's, very near and dear to yours and my heart. Why don't you, tell me about shamanism for you? How did you stumble into it, or did it find you, or how did that happen? And before we even do that, what, based on your experience, your studying, your teaching, what is the practice? What is shamanic practice in general? For those who are listening who have no idea,
okay.
I want to try to make this tangible for folks.
Well, I'm Irish, so we tell stories. That's what we do. So
okay.
I will tell you the story. So years ago when I was at the University of Chicago and I took this really fast class on mythology, I love mythology, and it was taught by Rick, who's probably dead now, but he was awesome. And we went through all these multiple ways of understanding what mythology was, in psychological ways, theater, enactment of theater, enactment of ritual. And one of the textbooks was this book, Shamanic Voices, because of course, mythology is deeply embedded in many shamanic systems. So I looked at that book and I was probably 25 years old. So we're talking, I don't know how long, that was 40 some years ago. I looked at it and I had this very, what I now know was a knowing. At the time, I wouldn't have called it that, but I can feel it right as I'm speaking. I looked at that book and I said to myself, oh, I'm going to have to get back to this. And then the class went on and I wrote my paper on tricksters and so on and so forth, right? So years later, I had gone to Ireland to live and I just come back. And I had a patient who was, in fact, Irish herself, and she was having a problem. She was a patient I'd had for many years and mostly treated mundane physical things. And she was having a much more serious problem. And I don't want to say what it was because it's a little bit too, just in case she should be listening or something. I don't want to, give her stories. But it had a psychological component. And what became clear was that it had a spiritual component. There were all, she was Irish. She was interested in the meaning of her dreams and what that was saying and whether or not she was, and things that were going on in her house and stuff, because Irish people have not completely succumbed to the idea that you're crazy if you think those things. So I realized, oh my God, this is, here I was already at that point, 20 years in, I guess, let's see, 19, close to 20 years into Chinese medicine, in this thing that was supposed to be about the body, mind, spirit. And I didn't have a damn clue as to how to work with anything that had to do with spirit. And in this case, I mean something that was not of this material world. And I thought, how can this be? Yeah, lots of psychology, lots of emotionalism, yada, yada, yada. That is not the same thing. That's something else. And in fact, a lot of spiritual systems think that emotion actually gets in the way of spiritual experience. I would say Buddhism thinks that in some ways. Is something you have to deal with to get it out of your way. So I didn't know what to do. I thought, how can I not have a clue how to work with this? And then within literally 2 months, a shamanic teacher showed up at this place that I was working and offered this workshop. It was like, you know, that when you need them, the teacher will come. Mm-hmm. So, and that was like 20 years after I'd seen that book and thought, I'm going to have to get back to this. So that's how it happened. Much like the Chinese medicine story. It's like, you know, you get pushed into something or now is the moment, like, you know, now's the time. So that's how I got into it. And now, did you want me to try? Did you ask me to define it? Is that what you said?
Yeah. Well, give for people who don't know what it is, right?
Okay.
People, or maybe have heard the word or seen some movie with the guy blowing smoke, like, what is shamanic practice for those who are unfamiliar?
So let me just say why I said it's not an ism. An ism is like Marxism, Buddhism, atheism. These are belief systems. Nothing wrong with belief systems. I'm a little bit of a Marxist myself. And I'm an anarchist myself and so forth. So I'm not against belief systems. But shamanic practices, there isn't anything called meditationism. Because meditation isn't an ism, it's a practice. And it's a practice that's in almost every religion in the world, has some form of meditation, including Christianity, Judaism, everybody, right? So shamanic practice is, but the interesting thing about shamanic practice, first off, it's very, very old. We think probably about 40,000 years old. So therefore, the oldest spiritual practice on the planet Earth. And it is known throughout the world. We have yet to find a culture that has not had some form of shamanic practice. And it is a practice in which either a specialized individual or sometimes many individuals in the community, depends on the culture, go into an altered state, which they can get into in a variety of ways, including psychedelics, but not exclusively that. Sometimes it's by sound and by dance and so forth, or by deprivation. That's like a vision quest where you don't eat for a few days and so forth. And the idea of it is that you are trying to, what the Irish would say is break the veil of this world into what the Irish call the other world. Now, in other cultures, they say worlds, plural. I think once you get through that veil, words like, you know, that become meaningless because it's a timeless, spaceless reality. So, you know, is it plural? Well, it feels kind of plural. So, and why do we do that? We do it to get information. And this is one of the things about it that I like. We get information and we bring it back for the good of all. So it's not just for the good of a single individual. That it might be good for a single individual, but shamanic practice has tended to focus on the group well-being and to see the interconnectedness within the group. So you go to the spirit world or worlds, you ask questions about what is going on in any particular situation. That could be a physical ailment. It could be bad luck. It could be what's going to happen. You know, we don't know what's coming. Can you tell us what's coming? Stuff like that used to be used to talk to the animals before the hunt. It's been used a lot on weather to affect the weather so that, you know, we got rain when we needed it and so forth. So the thing I love about it is not transcendent in the sense that it is not a goal to go to the spirit world and hang out there a lot. That isn't the goal. The goal is to go get something and bring it back to this world. So for the good of whoever you're trying to help, which I like because it's a spiritual system with a very pragmatic application. And I like that a lot about it.
So that's kind of the idea of being of service, right?
Yep, that's right. Yeah. And as I say, it was a collectivist. I have a friend who was, when he did his first shamanic workshop, the spirit that he contacted said to him, "Wait, you're a shaman? Where's your village? You can't be a shaman. You don't have a village." And so, and you'll be interested, Eric, because in the Tao Te Ching, where they're talking about how the leader doesn't lead, what they're talking about is a shaman. They're talking about a person who creates the energetic environment without anyone really being aware of it, in which people will thrive, get along, have enough food, and all that. They don't lead by pushing people around. They lead by creating harmony in all worlds. That's the other thing, is we're the walkers between the worlds. We're, our job is to create harmony among the worlds for the betterment of all of us, but particularly your village. You know,
I got slightly cut out of the conversation, but I'm back.
Come back, Eric.
I'm back. My phone kicked me out, and I'm back. So, you know, just full disclosure.
Oh, sorry.
So I'm following along, but, you know, just on a very empirical level, what was striking to me was when I first started doing my Zen retreats, and they're long and they're kind of like spiritual marathons, you might say, you know, they're meditative marathons. They're challenging. It's not easy to go on those kinds. People say zenning out like it's like,
like
going
fun
to the beach or something. No, it's not fun.
No, I've had friends who went on. They're very intense, I've heard.
They're intense, you know, but you learn, and you're there to go on a, you're there to go on the quest. And, but what really struck me in a very concrete way was you could kind of tell when other people got into their meditative zone, everybody would. It was an empirical thing.
Right.
And I was like, oh, this is real. Right. And I had this very distinct moment. Again, I was a noob. You know, as my seven-year-old would say, I was a noob. And I was sitting there, and, you know, things hurt, your knees hurt, your back hurts. And all of a sudden, in a flash, I was like, all the struggle, all the pain, all this is gone. And I looked across the meditation place, and it was like I saw the feet of the Zen master Hosokawa Roshi just walking through. And he was an unusual person in that he would sit through us through all the grind. You know, he didn't just hang out downstairs and wait for people to come down and talk with them about their Zen koans and stuff, talk about their Zen riddles. He was like doing it, you know, which I didn't realize how special that was until, you know, people explained to me, like, a lot of times Zen masters won't do that. And I saw him walking across, and I was like, wow, he is like broadcasting this thing out. He's channeling this thing in.
Yeah.
And then you start to realize, I can try to do this for other people too. This person's struggling next to me, I bet you if I try, I can make their breath relax a little bit. I can help them relax through this too. And of course, they'll do the same for me later.
Right.
It was like very like hands-on in the moment, like related to what you're talking about. It was like immediate. I was like, this is an empirical thing. You know, being empirical people.
Yep.
You know, wanting experiences. Yep. Like, no, this is real. Mm-hmm. One person can affect a whole room. Yep. One person can affect a whole community.
Yep.
You know, that's the activity.
Just because you did a whole psychedelics thing, I will say that the first time I know for sure I experienced that, I went to a party. I was never a huge druggie. I didn't care for acid. We can per se, not all hallucinogens, but acid in particular, I don't like. I think it's chemical and it feels mechanical to me. However, so I was not taking drugs. I was straight, as we used to say. Aha, back when straight meant something else. And I walked into this room and somebody was walking around giving out acid out of a chalice. And there was a huge, this is funny, it was dark and there was music. Oh, there was Janis Joplin, whom I did not like. I didn't like Janis Joplin. I walked into that room and I was so freaking high immediately. And I listened to her and I went, oh my God, I get this. I never got this before. Now, here's the cool thing, Daniel, you'll love this. I don't generally tell this, but I will tell it. One of my allies is an Irish wolfhound. And in that party, I was sitting on the floor with all these people tripping out of their minds. And this huge Irish wolfhound walked in the room. I think he was real, but you know, I'm not actually sure. And walked over to me, and they're huge. No, they're very big. And he leaned over, looked at me, and growled, and then walked away. Now, I'm not sure anyone else saw that. And years later, someone did a journey for me, and she said, well, here's the ally I brought for you. It's weird. It was this huge Irish wolfhound. So the point being, that was the first time I experienced what you're talking about happened at the Zen retreat, was this feeling of, wow, everybody else's thing. We used to call it a contact high. Well, that's a real thing, a contact high, for sure. And it's pretty interesting. Plus, it was good for me because I don't like acid and I didn't want to take acid. So. I'm not a huge, I validate anybody's right to take hallucinogens, but I haven't had super good experiences on them. Because my brain is trying to kill me. I don't need to help it, you know.
Well, you know what happened kind of interesting with that? Daniel brought up, I think maybe it was in that episode, like, why do people meditate? And there's tons of reasons why people meditate. But one of the reasons is to do that thing, to like be to have your presence there in that kind of a state. And then it has this influence, positive influence on the people around you.
Well, Daniel,
that's a reason to meditate.
Don't you?
And he knows that. Daniel knows that for sure, obviously.
Sure.
That's Daniel all over. But
and Daniel, don't you think that it's easier to journey in groups or not? Or do you think that?
It is. It is. But I think for our listeners, we should, Mary Kay, you should define what does that mean to journey?
Yeah, to journey. Okay. So going back to our definition, that is either a specialist or a group of people travel through this veil to the other world. Often that traveling, once you get very proficient, it doesn't feel like traveling. It almost feels like they come to you, but that's not important. You basically change your state of consciousness and are no longer in this material world in the same way. And that's called a journey. And it's called a journey because it feels like journeying. Sometimes it actually feels like you're going somewhere for a long, long time. It can take quite a long time. I watched a film about a Lapland shaman, and she was journeying for hours trying to keep this guy from dying. Like, she went into the land of the dead and got him and brought him back so he wouldn't die. And it was hours and hours. Now, the film wasn't hours, but they showed you that hours had passed. So so it feels like journeying. And even if the experience is only 20 minutes long, it can feel like it was a very long time. So that's why they're called journeys, is they feel like journeys. But so it's going into this altered state in order to communicate with anything that wants to communicate. I say the spirits, but one of the most profound journeys I ever had was to this rock, this cave and this rock. And it was so profound and it was so unexpected. So that's when I got it, that everything is alive. Everything is alive.
That's I mean, that's definitely my experience with it. And so for people who are listening, how would you say that the practice of that shamanic practice has validity or place in people's lives, you know, who regular people? I mean, how would you, if you were to not convince somebody, but provide someone with information who is listening to this part of the podcast or this episode, and they're saying, okay, I hear what you're saying. So someone's going to have an altered mind state based on who knows what, how they get there, but they're altered and they're going to, you know, enter into, as you call it, which I like the definition, how you called it, a timeless, spaceless reality, to get information back for an individual and the community for the benefit of all other beings. How can this be useful for somebody in the reality that we live now? Because as you mentioned earlier, this is a very traditional practice. So at one point, somebody needed to find out, you know, where are the buffalo going, or where are the wild boars so we could hunt, or how do we, you know, position our crops so that they grow effectively. But this is not really a place in which, or situations in which most people encounter their struggles in life. So how can, you know, shamanic practice in a contemporary setting, or even if I say it in an urban setting, how does that play out? Do you feel like, cause we all live in these kind of urban settings, right? Cities and suburbs and things like that. How do you see that in your experience through your teaching?
Well, there are at least two parts. There are many parts, but the two big things are, there's the way in which you could be benefited because someone did some journeys for you. That's one way. And the other way would be, you could be benefited because you learned how to journey. And those are two different things. Do you want me to talk about both of those or one of those? Both of them. Okay. So the way it could help you personally is twofold. On a personal level, I think the time to to seek out that kind of help is when, you know, common things are common. That's what they say in medical school. And common interventions are common, right? If you have a headache, you don't go to a brain surgeon. You go to the medicine cabinet and get some aspirin, right? So you start out with simple interventions that are commonly known and that are the ones that are usual. And that's what everybody in the world does. Most people don't. They have a headache and then they go to a shaman. Unless they've had headaches for 6 months and nothing works. So I would say you go to a shamanic intervention when the normal kinds of things, and by normal, I include Chinese medicine, chiropractic, psychotherapy. I think many times people have gone to a therapist. The therapist was good. They did their best, but it isn't moving the problem. It really isn't changing. And then you might seek out a shamanic person because the idea would be this problem is bigger than just you. It's about connectedness. It's about either that, or maybe it's about the past or the future. Who knows? There are many things it could be, and we can talk about the various categories that we see at some point if you want to. But so I think that's when people go, and that would be true even in traditional societies. You don't necessarily stub your toe and then go to a shaman, unless you're in West Africa, because stubbing your toe has to do with your destiny. But in normal circumstances, you wouldn't. But if you got sick, nobody could seem to get it better. And then your mother, her house burned down, and then your brother broke his leg. And then you might really go, okay, what's going on here? Why? Because you see things collectively. Or maybe you get sick and you lose your job, and then something else happens to something. And then you think, what is going on here? This is a conglomeration of problems. So that's when it might help a person. Now, that's part 1A. Part 1B, see, did I go to the UFC or what, Eric? part 1B is a group. Now, these people do not do this, but I really wish they would. People in a group should think about seeking out a shamanic intervention if they are having problems in their group. So for instance, this is some work that my friend Liz and I are interested in, is if you're, let's say you're a social activist and you're doing what we call in my house, the Lord's work. That is, you're trying to make a better world by, you know, fighting the bad guys and, you know, all that stuff. And your group is having all kinds of conflict and trouble and tiredness and just not working very well. Well, you can call in a conflict resolution guy if you want. Those things are notoriously ineffective. And I got that statement from people who teach conflict resolution. Those kinds of rational psychological interventions are notoriously ineffective, and they frequently cause more fighting and more conflict. Not always, but often. It would be very wise to bring in a shamanic person who can scope out what is the big issue here that you guys don't have any clue what it is. You think you know. That's the other thing, is we think we know. We tell the same story over and over. If the story is the right story, it'll change things. If it isn't changing things, it's not the right story. Mm. So that's how you could get shamanic intervention to help you. Mm-hmm. In terms of becoming a shamanic practitioner, there's a part A and B to that too. So now we're on 2A. that is a lot of, like, Michael Harner, he's kind of the grandfather of this resurgence of shamanism, you know, went around the world trying to find traditional people who teach and so on and so forth. He's dead now, but he's a really important character. He really wanted to create a kind of shamanic practice that would allow anybody to have an experience of the other world, or what he called non-ordinary reality. And so this is the kind of democratized, very American, right? The democratization of shamanic practice. And I think that's a good thing. In the same way, I think psychedelics can be a good thing. Because even if you're not going to go into it in a big way, like you're not going to become a professional shamanic practitioner, you still will see that what you think the world is, it ain't. Like, that's the thing about it that's so wonderful, is what you think it is, it ain't. The world, there are larger things than are dreamt of in your philosophy, Horatio. And so you can have a glimpse of the fact that this is not the only world, that the way the world looks is largely a function of how your eyes are set up and how your ears work. If you were a spider, the world would look very different. And so you can have that experience. So it's, I call that shamanism light. It's kind of when you put your toe in because you just want to see. That's valid. And I think that could be very transformative. And then part 2B is people who go into it in a big way and then become people who want to try to help others by doing all these various kinds of interventions and journeys for them. So does that help, Daniel?
Mm-hmm.
Just as the person kind of coming in asking about part 2A, so when you two think about this, is that something where someone goes to, we have a listener who's interested in this, is that someone who goes to seek out someone to be, to help them put their toes in the water, or is that something that someone could do kind of just independently without having to, or what do you think? Is that, I mean, obviously it's always better to have a teacher, but.
I think, Daniel, do you want to say anything about that or shall I?
I think you definitely, for me personally, I think that a teacher, somebody whom you hold in high regard and who you respect as a person and as a well-balanced sort of individual, or if life presents someone to you, is probably the way to begin. Because they provide you with some, not necessarily framework, but maybe like a cork board to put ideas on and bounce things off of through your experience. Because some people, like Mary Kay had alluded to earlier, after the beginning of training, sometimes might have some turbulence in their life or in their psyche or in their dreams or something like that. And doing it on your own, maybe it works out really well and nothing ever goes wrong. And that's awesome. But for most people, like we've been saying all show long, life is tricky. And so when some of this trickiness starts to come up, where then do you go? You need sort of a trusted ally. So I think having somebody as an ally, as sort of a guide, or as they call it in the Buddhist tradition, right? A spiritual friend to kind of get you going, show you the ropes, and provide you really with the opportunity to journey. And what I mean by that is we talked about earlier about sharing sort of motivation, sharing a mind, being able to motivate somebody or provide the space for them to work in is really important, because if someone is not having the success that they're looking to have early on and it's just very difficult, then at that point you sort of need the experience and sort of energetic gravitas of somebody who's been doing it for a while to help get you over the hump and help you your teacher helps you with your faith, with believing in what it is that you experience. And we kind of alluded to that earlier as experience, that experience is the motivator and validator of spirituality, if I use my own definition. But in order to have the motivation, in order for things to be validated, you have to believe in what it is that you're experiencing, the sights, sounds, and teachings that you're getting. And so for most people, from my experience, and I'd love to hear what Mary Kay has to say, it's not about people having a trouble, you know, oh, I can't see anything, or I can't hear anything, or I'm not experiencing something. That's actually more rare from my experience. For most people, they'll say, well, I don't know, I just saw like Jesus walking towards me and he gave me this amulet and told me I'm going to do great things in my life. Just give me a few months and I should really clean up my diet and work on being compassionate. But I don't know, whatever. That's probably not real. But I'm like, hold on, wait a minute. You just came to this room, laid down with your eyes closed. I played some music and that's what you saw. And you don't believe that.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So providing people with the ability to believe in their own ability to take divine revelation on an individual basis, I think actually is probably the most important aspect of a good teacher in this sense.
So I think, Eric, this does resonate a lot with the Buddhist traditions that I have followed and understand a bit. And that is, I really, you can buy a book and you can buy tapes. I don't think it's a good idea. In fact, I don't mean to disrespect anybody out there. Everybody has a right to make a living. Shamans have charged either money or chickens or whatever for centuries. So there's nothing wrong with the idea of people paying you to learn. What I have a problem with is the commoditization of the training such that anybody is allowed into a class. That's dangerous because, as you said in one of your podcasts, and I believe it was Chökyam Trungpa who said, you don't want to try to lose your ego until you actually have one. You need to have a good ego structure before you try to destroy it, because otherwise you're likely to end up in the loony bin on lockdown. And so I think that I don't let everyone into, I interview every single person, and I, one time, and Daniel will know when this was, I let someone in that I knew I shouldn't. I knew I shouldn't, and it has never ceased to be a problem up to this very minute. So I don't allow anybody just because they have, you pay your money, you take your chances. And that is not how it usually goes. The classes are very large sometimes. That worries me because I don't know how teachers are monitoring what's going on. And also, although some of them are very psychic, so I don't want to disrespect them, but I've been to classes where there were like 150 people. Now that's ridiculous. In my opinion, that is not a shamanic class. That's my opinion. But the other thing is that I take on a student forever. So if you take one single class with me, you can call me for the rest of your life if you need to, because of my friend who took a workshop and had this break and ended up in the psych ER, and he called the trainers and they did not return his calls. And that worries me because this is serious stuff. Now, by and large, it's quite safe. That kind of really weird response, I could count how many times that's happened, maybe on one hand. So it's not like it's, and I've taught a fair number of people at this point, it's not common. But on the other hand, I don't want someone in a psych lockdown because I didn't bother to keep up on them. So I have a problem with the whole, I'm going to buy a book and listen to a tape. And but since you guys are Tantra guys, I worked on a guy in Ireland who'd gotten a book on Tantra. And he did some Tantra stuff. And guess what happened? He invited in this kind of succubus spirit who proceeded to suck the life out of him for 2 years. By the time he got to me, he could barely function. And luckily we did some work, and that's another really interesting story because he got really mad when I took her off, and blah, blah, blah. But point is, he shouldn't have bought a book on Tantra. Tantra's serious business. Anytime you mess around with energy, it's serious. And not in the, you know, doesn't mean you can't laugh or have fun, but it means somebody there has to be willing to look after you and make sure you're okay. And I think that is part of the largely the meditation tradition, or at least in certain circles. I think that's true. You can tell me if I'm wrong, Eric, but that's what I am.
Well, yeah, okay. So I'm going to I'm going to play the role too that, you know, sometimes Daniel plays too, which would be if there's a listener out here who's interested then, right? Because, you know, part of the goal of the whole thing is to give people exposure to things and, oh, that speaks to me. This fascinates me. I actually want to go further. Well, how does someone do that if, you know, they're out in the middle of wherever the heck they are.
They can certainly talk to Daniel or I. However, if they're out in wherever, I would say that one thing you can look for is a certification by the Foundation for Shamanic Studies. That was Michael Harner's group. That's an actual certification. However, there are people out there who are legit who don't have that. I don't actually have that. However, I did take some Harner workshops just so I would know what that was and sort of get what their, you know, what their deal is. So that's one thing, is you can actually look for credentials, but I would never, ever, ever take a class that I hadn't met the teacher, unless maybe if they were recommended by someone else. Although I took a class once that was recommended by someone, and that teacher was a dangerous, crazy person. So I think the second thing is go with your gut. You might as well learn to trust your feelings right now, because you're going to have to learn to do it if you're going to do shamanic work anyway. You might as well start right now. And if anything about that teacher seems off to you in any way, you just don't care for them. They rub you the wrong way. It doesn't, you don't have to justify it. If they don't feel right to you, don't take a workshop with them. It's no judgment on them. Maybe you just don't share karma or whatever that Buddhist idea is of who can be your teacher. So don't go with someone who feels off to you. And anybody who tries to do anything kind of sexual that's bizarre or anything that just seems creepy in any way, because they're, unfortunately, I have run into some, you know, every spiritual tradition gets creepy people. I don't know what it is. Well, it's what the Dalai Lama says is that when people amass power, there's a huge temptation to go the wrong direction with it. Mm-hmm. And he thinks that's a very sad thing when that happens. And I think that
happens we haven't done that episode yet. It's on our kind of like list of the to-do list of episodes. But that kind of advice is very good because you really do have to watch that, right?
Right.
There are going to be people where you're, okay, part of it might just be a personality thing. Like, I don't vibe with this person. That's fine. And some of it might be even more serious. Like, this person has issues.
Yeah.
And they haven't come to terms with these issues. And this is negatively impacting the students around them. And I mean, that's all bad news. And you have to be aware that that's a thing, right? Yeah. So, yeah, thanks for saying that so bluntly, Mary Kay. That's true.
Yeah,
so,
just be safe. I think that's true for any spiritual tradition. Be safe.
Absolutely.
Go with your gut. And I, frankly, I would be cautious about things like buying tapes and all that. But here's what I would say. If you're already doing that and you've already bought a book and you're already kind of in that, fine. Get yourself someone like Daniel or me who'll help you in case you get in trouble. And I'm happy. You can put our emails out. If you feel like you've gotten in trouble, and what does in trouble mean? It means you start having nightmares. You start feeling very disoriented. You get really depressed. You get really anxious. You just feel a certain kind of ennui and discomfort. All of those things are things that might happen. It's unlikely, but it's possible. And the farther into the practice you get, the more likely it is that you will run into stuff because somehow it's self-regulating. People who just put a toe in rarely have bad experience. It does happen, but it's not that common. But the farther you get into it, I mean, I did a workshop in which we had to go and talk to our own death, and they took us to the door of death. He brought a practicing physician to that workshop because he wanted to make sure there was a doctor there. Because it was, so that is not a beginner's workshop. And so make sure you, if you're going to take a class, make sure it's a beginner class. Don't start. Don't take the death and dying workshop, you know?
Good point.
Well, just like 21st century America, are people doing, you know, shamanistic teachings from afar? Would you have students that you would have more long distance relationships? Someone is in Maine and you would have a relationship with them where you would be guiding them. I mean, you're not physically in the same space. Are people doing that, or is that still something that
I don't know
that would be ill advised?
Yes, the answer is yes. There are shamanic classes. Yeah. There are
oh yeah.
Shamanic classes you could find online and
yeah, right. And even famous people are doing them. Mm-hmm. The Soul Retrieval Gal does one of those.
So if someone have a relationship with one of you two, that's not an impossibility for them to go, well, I'm down in Austin.
No.
This is really interested.
I would not.
You would not do that. Okay.
Not, no.
Okay. You want someone who's a student that you're with.
If you recall, I said I was an artist when I first started, and that's what I'm doing again now. I'm a very visual and auditory person. I need to see you. I can't treat patients I haven't seen. I have to see you. I got to look at you. To me, looking is more important than pulse or tongue or anything else. It's looking. And I can't do it. I'm not a very good distance worker. We have a friend, Barb. She's so good at distance work. It's uncanny. She's worked on me from a distance and I was fixed within a half an hour. I'm not good at distance work. So I would keep up on a student who was at a far distance. They could call me and talk to me and we could work out stuff and I could make that kind of thing. But I wouldn't try to teach someone from a distance. But I don't know, maybe some other people can do it. I don't know. I mean, there are some pretty powerful people out there. I don't know. Do you know Molly Doma?
No.
Okay, he's an African guy. I like him. He's an African guy. He may do some of that distance teaching. I'm not sure. I don't want to say he does, but.
Well, I think to your point earlier, Mary Kay, the whole point would be to kind of, you know, interview somebody, do your research, and then go with your gut, right?
Yeah.
Because you have to eventually believe yourself.
Yeah.
So, you know, this has been I have personally learned a lot today throughout the course of our conversation. I'm going to ask Eric if he has any parting shots before we bid adieus to our longtime friend, Mary Kay. Eric, you got anything in parting?
No, just thanks for sharing everything, Mary Kay. It's been a pleasure for sure.
It's been a hoot, you guys. And I think that, I don't know if this is, you can edit this out if you want to, but if there are people out there who have one of two experiences, A, they would like to get trained, or B, they have feel they have had some kind of scary, negative, whatever, I'm available to talk to those people and try to help them find a teacher, see what kind of help we could get them for their negative, whatever. I can't promise I can fix it, but it worries me that people are out there who might be doing things that aren't safe. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I'm happy to help someone to the extent I can.
And so for those people who, thank you, Mary Kay, for that. And for those people who that applies to, you can just leave a message for the show, leave a voice message for the show, and then I, with your email, and I will then pass that email along to Mary Kay, and she will then contact you. That's the best way to do that. So Mary Kay, just thanks for coming on. I certainly learned a ton. It was a really stimulating conversation. I'm really glad that we had you on. We hope to have you back at some point to take a deeper dive, if that's possible. But I think we could find a way.
A deeper dive.
Yeah.
Like well underwater.
Yeah.
Well into the deep.
Yeah.
The deep.
Yeah. So
the positive sense of the deep, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. We'll next time we'll put the ankle weights on to see if we can get a little bit.
Jesus. Thank you. I really appreciate your having me. It was really fun. So
we definitely the first of many times, Mary Kay, for sure.
Yeah. A lot of fun. Yeah. I'm going to talk to Roll and see if we can't get some, you know, not white people and stuff to help you guys out.
We love all
people. Diversity is good, is all I'm saying.
Absolutely.
And I love you both, even as white men. I love you.
Well, okay.
Yeah. We love you too, Mary Kay. So again, thank you, Mary Kay, for coming on, and for Eric, this is Daniel saying thank you much, and enjoy your Jin and Tantra. Until next time.
Good night, guys. Bye.